Well, what I'd like to do this afternoon is just have a very brief look at Hosea. Because the book of Hosea is very, very interesting. It's one of the sort of major minor prophets, one of the longer ones. And it has several things in it which parallel today very much. So if you turn to Hosea, just after Daniel. Hosea 1, verse 1. The word of the Eternal came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, it's rather interesting that Hosea is actually writing at the same basic time as Isaiah. If you want to just quickly look at the very first verse of Isaiah. Isaiah 1, verse 1. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So you can see these books were both written at the same basic sort of time. Now, I did a little bit of arithmetic because you can link up the kings, because there's one or two references that cross-reference the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel. And it seems that Hosea was giving his prophecy starting some 80 years before the actual captivity, which seems to parallel what Mr. Armstrong has done quite remarkably. So we got verse 2, at the beginning of the word of the Eternal to Hosea. So this is a message from God through Hosea, which is exactly what happened with Mr. Armstrong, isn't it? It was revealed knowledge. And the Eternal said to Hosea, go take your wife of whoredoms and the children of whoredoms, for the land has committed great whoredom, departing from the Eternal. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. And the Eternal said to him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and I will cause to cease the kingdom from the house of Israel. Now, you know, that's one of the very first messages that Mr. Armstrong gave, talking about the dictator arising and the dictator that would come and take into captivity both Britain and America. Now, this was given about the same time. This was given roughly 80 years before the captivity actually occurred. Now, I know we tend to look at Hosea and we think the first thing that comes into our mind is, well, this is a message to Ephraim. Well, it is, but it's also very much directed at the house of Israel. So, Manasseh, you're not let off the hook. As you'll see later, you have exactly the same problems. Another point, it was obviously written for the people of that time, but it was also aimed at us today. If you turn to, just drop down to Hosea 1, verse 7, you'll see it says there, God said, but I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God. And they actually remained free for over 100 years after Israel went into captivity. But if you just go forward to chapter 5, verse 5, it says, and the pride of Israel does testify to his face, therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their lawlessness, which is what iniquity means in modern English, Judah also shall fall with them. So suddenly, from being spared and shown mercy, they're now falling with both Ephraim and Manasseh and the rest of the Israelitish countries. So as you can see, this is very much a prophecy, you know, for us today. Just to let you know the dates, Israel was taken into captivity 721 to 718 BC. Which meant that Hosea must have started prophesying around about 800 years before Christ. Judah went into captivity over 100 years later, 604, the final invasion being 585 BC. So this is very much a message to modern-day Israel. So what was the problem? Hosea 2, verse 11. We're just going to pick out a few key verses here and try and get to the bottom of what Hosea's message was all about. Because as we go through this, keep in mind what Mr. Armstrong's been preaching and how, for instance, the sermon we had just the other week there sounded like he was giving it to us today. It wasn't 30 years old. It was very topical. Hosea 2 verse 11. Here we start getting down to the root of the problem. God says, I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. There's your problem. They had departed from the feasts, God's feasts and God's Sabbath, and they were doing their own thing, which of course is what mankind is still doing today. Now, Mr. Armstrong, writing in the booklet, Which Day is the Christian Sabbath?, writes, probably you have never understood the prophecy of Hosea before. It cannot be really understood unless you first understand the Sabbath covenant. So let's go back to Exodus 31. The only answer that some of the people who took worldwide off the track had to this particular scripture, by the way, was, it's Old Testament, isn't it? Yes. Exodus 31 verse 13. Speak you also unto the children of Israel, saying, verily my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout all your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal that does sanctify you. Now I think that's a pretty important thing, isn't it? It's the one thing that's a sign between God and his people. So I think that's pretty important. In fact, it's not pretty important, it's vital. You have people in the world that will laugh and say, oh, well, it's the Jewish Sabbath. The Sabbath was in force 2,500 years before a single Jew walked on the earth. It's been around since creation. Israel lost that sign, the Holy Sabbath, and they became known as the Lost Ten Tribes. They lost their identity. To the stage now where when Mr. Armstrong brought all this up, people were just, you know, poo-pooing it. How ridiculous. Oh, that was some idea that some people had in the 1800s, British Israel Society and so on. However, Judah kept the Sabbath, and Judah came out of captivity, and they rebuilt the temple. And today, as far as the world's concerned, the Jews are God's chosen people. But you see, they're in for a bashing as well, because they've got other problems, serious problems. So the nations of modern Israel were destroyed. And the big question, obviously, is why? Well, go to Hosea 4, verse 6. If you go to Hosea 4, verse 6. And it starts to become a little bit obvious. Hosea 4 verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. For lack of knowledge. Now, I don't think that's discussing the lottery numbers or who's going to win the football pools or, you know, who's going to die next in EastEnders. Yes? Knowledge of what? It says, because you have rejected knowledge, I also reject you, that you shall be no more a priest to me, seeing that you have forgotten the law of your God. That's the knowledge. I said, I also will forget your children. That's the knowledge that they conveniently forgot. And if you try going today and explaining to any Christian about the Sabbath, I mean, they've got 101 excuses as to why they shouldn't keep it. He says, see, you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. But they were warned. If you turn to Hosea 5 verse 9 now. One of the hardest things that the work under Mr. Armstrong had to get round was getting the message to Ephraim. Because the government blocked it. Every kind. You couldn't get on. The BBC at that stage had total control over all the broadcasting. And yet in verse 5 verse 9, it says, Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Now, when something's desolate, it means it's desolate. There's nobody left. The land is just left fallow. The people have all been taken or killed. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. the message that God is going to punish Ephraim and Manasseh and the other Israelitish countries because they've forgotten the knowledge that they had originally. They've forgotten even who they were because they ditched the sign. They got rid of the Sabbath. If you turn to Hosea 7, verse 12, here's another reminder of a similar thing. Hosea 7, verse 12. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I will bring them down as the fowls of heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation has heard. There's nobody that can say they haven't heard. What is there? Well, there's a whole lot of people that haven't heard. The younger generation today haven't heard. They'll hear right before the end, but the message has gone out and the message has been rejected. During Mr. Armstrong's ministry, do you actually get some idea of the magnitude of the work that this man was the head of, that this man inspired, that he led? Right up until within a year or two of his death, he was still running people 30 and 40 years into the ground with his energy. He just kept going. It was like he had an internal dynamo in him. I know I went to Luton several times to help get everybody back from the airport when they flew in. And Mr. Armstrong would strut off the plane and shake hands with everybody. And he was in the car and off. And following would be the ministers who came with him, a bedraggled-looking lot, half asleep. And I said to Mr. Hunting one time, I said, why don't you all get some sleep? I mean, obviously, Mr. Armstrong's had a good dose. He said, no. He's written a plain truth article. He's halfway through a member letter, and he's beaten us all in cards. Yeah? And he's strutting away there, and all the others are bags under their eyes and everything. The man just had a zeal. I think I've mentioned before that my graduation, we snuck back on campus having been to a news event, and 12 o'clock at night, and we were in there, and he wanted to see the pictures that took 4 hours to produce. He wanted to listen to all the tapes. He never went to bed. He rewrote his graduation address. That night he was at the Bible study, took the whole Bible study, took the whole Sabbath service, went to the final basketball game on Saturday night, had all the ministers over for a drink after the final basketball game, which was probably after, 10 o'clock at night. And Mr. Hunting came into the office in the morning and said, Mr. Armstrong wanted a few bits and pieces, which I got. And I said, well, should I take him to the lodge? He said, oh, no, he'll be in Jerusalem in an hour's time. He's having lunch with Teddy Kolek. So I don't know when he slept that weekend. He certainly didn't get any sleep Thursday night. He might have grabbed a few hours on Friday night. Saturday night would have gone into the wee hours. And he'd had to have been gone at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to fly to Jerusalem. When he was running the work sent out over 40 million pieces of literature. 40 million. The work was the largest TV and religious broadcaster in the world. If you look down the list, the second one down the list is not even half the number of TV and radio stations that the Worldwide Church of God had at that stage. Mr. Armstrong spoke to the vast majority of political leaders, the ones that really mattered. I think we might actually try and get a list of everybody that he actually spoke to and print it one day so you can see everybody. It was absolutely amazing. And some people even accused the church of rigging all this so that it could just appear that he was going to do this. But you know what? I mean, I was involved a little bit in the beginning of it, and they were invited. Everything was invitations. Even the way that King Leopold got to speak with Mr. Armstrong in the first place. He actually asked Mr. Armstrong to come speak to him because he wanted to hear more. And you see, once you start networking with somebody like King Leopold, who knows everybody, that's when it all started. And once you speak to one, you get invited to another. But you know, only God can open doors like that. You just don't get to speak to the leader of a nation by picking up the phone and saying, I want to come and talk to you. Yeah, right. You try and get an appointment with the President of the United States, you'd be lucky if you even get put on the list as an ordinary person. Mr. Armstrong did all that and more. And I say, right up, I think we've all heard the sermon he gave on Trumpets, 1985, what, just a few months before he died. And there was no flagging there, was there? Oh, he was complaining because he couldn't, his magnifying glass wasn't working too well, basically. He was having trouble reading the scriptures. But the mind was still as sharp as a tack, right to the end. Now, Hosea was putting out a very similar message all those years before. Hosea 1, go back to Hosea 1. Hosea 1, verse 6. Poor old Hosea. The servants of God back in that day had a bit of a rough time. You know, go marry a prostitute. It's not exactly everybody's cup of tea. Verse 6, chapter 1. And she conceived again and bore a daughter. And God said to him, call her name Lo-ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. I will utterly take them away. And this is the same sort of message that Mr. Armstrong was putting out. Now, there's another link here, which we'll cover in a few minutes, but I'll just mention it here. All through the book of Hosea, there are encouraging patches as well, pointing to the future, pointing to the fact what Israel will be in the future once they get sorted out. It's not all bash them over the head and bury them. And that's what Mr. Armstrong was doing as well. You know, so much of it was encouragement. And, you know, go through some of the booklets. Go through US and GB and Prophecy. I mean, you pull the guts of that booklet out, it's pretty devastating. And yet, look at where it leads. Look at what it points to. And, of course, if you're watching the news at the moment, I think we can see that everything's falling into place. You even have Germany now talking about an inner core within Europe. And somebody twigged and they said, but hold on, we've already got a two-speed Europe. We've got the Eurozone, the 17 nations, and we've got the 27 nations. So they're two different groups. And then you get Mr. Barroso saying, if you're in Europe, you should be using the currency. It's in the treaty. You try and find it in the treaty. But what they do is they take a bit from page 3 and a bit from page 9 and a bit from page 37 and they string it all together and then the lawyers put their twist on it and it's in the treaty. That's how that treaty's written. It's very, very clever. And most of the people who voted for it never read it. I've read it from cover to cover. It's the most boring thing I've ever done. But you know what? If we renege on European laws, they have the right to come into this country and take it over. Written, it's in the treaty. It's in the Lisbon Treaty. In three different places, yes. String them together, and that's what's there. And you know what? That's exactly what's going to happen. Well, back to the future. Hosea 5. Hosea 5, verse 10. The princes of Judah were like them that remove the boundary. Therefore, I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. You see, Judah's also got a bit of a rough time coming up. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked away from the commandment. Now, I've got to be careful here because if I start listing the laws, the very laws that they've put into place regarding certain sort of ways of life, I can be arrested and slung in jail for hate speech. That's how bad it's got. Therefore, I will be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness. That's kind of a serious warning. Now here's verse 13, 5 verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb, yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound. Now, there's a number of things here that are very interesting. First of all, the word sickness is translated three different ways in the Old Testament. It's translated disease, it's translated sickness, and it's translated grief. Now, you can read into that wherever you like, but there are other scriptures that seem to indicate that Ephraim gets clobbered in one day. And I know we've speculated in the past if something's going to happen to the government, that the government is taken up, drop a 747 on the Houses of Parliament or something. But there's something else interesting here. You see, Judah saw his wound. This is a wound in conflict. so it would appear, and again, there's a speculation here, but on the other hand, a wound is a wound. And Judah, there are 7 million people living in the state of Israel today. 7 million. 1 million of them are Arabs. They are Israeli Arabs. So we have 6 million Jews surrounded by 400 to 500 million Arabs. Most of these nations are now armed to the teeth with all the latest weaponry. It doesn't make sense that those 6 million Jews still survive, quite frankly. They should be run over by 2 o'clock this afternoon. Well, 3 o'clock this afternoon. Yeah. The Arab people should be able to walk in there and just take that country over. But they are, it would appear, going to get a wound. Now, here's the other thing that struck me. If Israel got a wound, let's just say Iran lobbed one of their missiles over with an atomic warhead and flattened Tel Aviv, right? Where would Judah go? They'd have America, wouldn't they? Mr. Netanyahu would be straight on the phone to his good friend, Mr. Obama, who can't stand the sight of him. Bit of a bad slip, that. If you're wearing a microphone, you make sure it's switched off. So where's America? Where is America when Judah gets this wound? If this country had a major, major tragedy, we would tend to look more to America for help than we would Europe. But no, we go to the Assyrian. This King Jareb. Got various meanings on his name, but it's obviously referring to the Assyrian. Yet he could not heal you nor cure you of your wound. So, you know, King Jareb is not going to be helping either Judah or Ephraim. In fact, thinking to get the Assyrian as a helper against what is God's judgment on Ephraim for sin, Israel is actually going to be he's actually expecting help from God's avenger, leading him into captivity as a deserter from God. If you think about it, he's going to the Assyrian for help. But meanwhile, if you read in Isaiah 10, verse 5, I'll just quote it to you. This is what God says to them, you see. O Assyrian, rod of my anger and a staff in my hand, a staff in their hand is in my indignation, I will send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him charge to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the street. So what does Ephraim do? He goes to the Assyrian for help. Does this make any sense at all? I was just talking to Mr. Bowles this week, quoting a newspaper article where this guy was trying to sort the mess out at the moment, and he ended up by saying, the whole of Europe is just insane. Well, the whole world's insane because the power that runs this world today has got a twisted, devious, demented mind. See, could Ephraim, who's about to be thrashed, flattened, taken into captivity by the Assyrian, going to the Assyrian for the help. Is it not interesting that after the Second World War, almost immediately after the war, the Americans come along with the Marshall Plan, and they rebuild Europe. Now the Russians went into East Germany, which they annexed, and Poland, and they took out all the good factories. And they took them to Russia. They lifted the whole factories up, rebuilt them in Russia. Because what they said was, we're going to make these Germans a nation of farmers so they can never rise up against us again. I think that's a pretty good idea. I've been beaten up twice by the Germans, and the Russians particularly, lost millions and millions of people. Why not? But no, Uncle Sam goes in with all barrels of dollars, and rebuilds Germany, rebuilds German industry, and as Mr. Armstrong said way back in the late 1940s, be careful, we are rebuilding a Frankenstein monster that's going to turn on us and take us into captivity. And he said that before 1950. Nobody believed him. But what's happening right now? If you drop down to verse 15 of chapter 5, what we're going to do is read the last verse of chapter 5 and the first verse of chapter 6, because there's no chapter break in the actual message. Verse 15, I will go and return to my place, this is God speaking, until they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early. This is why God is going to do this to Israel, Britain and America, and the other Western European nations. He wants to get their attention. He wants them to admit they've been wrong. He wants them to want to go the right way. And then he'll pour his spirit out on them, won't he? Turn to verse 1 of chapter 6. Then the people say, when they're in the tribulation, come, let us return to the Eternal, for he has torn, he will heal us. He has smitten, and he will bind us up. How do they know this? Verse 2, after 2 days will he revive us. In the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. Mr. Armstrong mentions in U.S. and G.B. in Prophecy, quote, the coming great tribulation will probably last about 2.5 years, and the day of the Lord about 1 year. Then comes the resurrection and the second coming of Christ. Unless those days are shortened. But here it is. After 2 days, he will revive us. How do they know that? Well, there'll be the two witnesses, won't there? And when do the two witnesses start witnessing? Just before the captivity? So many things we could speculate about here, but they're going to somehow get the message. And when they go into the captivity, I mean, some of our children. I've got one child who's not baptized, not in the church. If he goes, there's a promise there in Chronicles that God will protect them all the way through. But I'll tell you, he talks to me regularly. He knows what's going on out there. He can see it happening. And suddenly finds himself in the tribulation, they'll be calling out pretty quick, won't they? They'll be calling out for God's protection because they'll realize that what they were taught as kids was actually right. And God says, he'll seal them. I actually wonder about, is it Psalm 91? You know, you talk about, you know, 1,000 will die at your left hand, 10,000 at your right hand, and it won't come nigh thee. Is this perhaps a message to some of them in Laodicea who are in the tribulation, or the people who come through the tribulation that form the human beings that go into the kingdom of God? Because they're going to see that, aren't they? They're going to see the result. I mean, what Germany did in the last war, some of it was quite incredible. It's hard to even take in the things they did. Just took a whole village out and just mowed them down. Right? That's nothing. That is kindergarten standard compared to what the Catholic Church is going to be doing in the tribulation. The tribulation is just not a place to be. Drop down to, let's see, chapter 7. Another thing which is rather interesting. Chapter 7, verse 7. They are all hot as an oven and have devoured their judges. All their kings are fallen. There is none among them that calls to me. You see? The only time people call to God is by taking his name in vain. When something goes wrong, they say, oh my God. But they don't mean it. See, God doesn't come into it. It's just become an expression, doesn't it? Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Now this is rather interesting. Let's take the cake not turned. What is actually God? If somebody said to you, you're a cake not turned, would you be insulted? Evidently, you go back into Adam Clark. He explains that what they did in those days to bake a cake or a loaf of bread, you had your oven and they'd stoke the old fire up in the oven, but the bottom was smooth. And when the fire was just to the right temperature, they'd put a blade in and push the fire to the one side and they'd put the bread or the cake in. Now that's great. It's getting cooked from the bottom. It's getting hot air a bit on the top. But it's getting this real heat from the side. So you had to keep on going in and turning it round and turning it round and turning it round until it was cooked evenly. Now a cake not turned would come out burnt on the one side and gooey on the other. In other words, you're useless, is what God is saying to them. All couched in language that people would understand back then. You're useless. Totally useless. Ephraim has mixed himself among the people. Well, we've had that in the news, haven't we, the last couple of weeks? We all had to go and get biometric passports, which are really cool. They've got the little chip in the back, and they just pass it over a scanner, and they've got all your details, what toothpaste you use, your shoe size, I mean, just about everything is in that chip. Of course, they didn't think that if a terrorist got a reader, they could just stand there and just check who's American or who's British, and they could just pop them off. But that's another story. But we have this system. And when people come into the country, particularly when they come from certain nations, we give them a rough time, but we make sure they are who they say they are. Or do we? Control of its borders is the way in which a nation defends its security and identity. Yet to judge from some recent developments, Britain's security and identity and parts of its civil service have descended into a near farcical shambles. To cut a long story short, they're still arguing as to who gave who the message. But what happened was, because they were busy and the queues were getting a little bit long, they just started letting people through. Who have they let through? I don't know. So now the chappie in charge of the department has resigned, blazing away at the government, and the government's blazing away at him. What a mess. But of course, this is not happening in America, is it? I've got an article here, Suicide of a Superpower. This is a gentleman called Frosty Wooldridge. With a name like Frosty, I'm afraid he does have to be a Manassite, yes. Have you noticed more and more languages being spoken across America rather than English? Have you noticed the meats at the supermarket must be stamped halal for Muslim consumption? Have you noticed cab drivers with turbans? I thought he said carbines. Turbines, yes. Have you noticed that Christmas, Easter, and now Halloween, once powerful American traditions and powerful traditions of American life, should they have been, they've now been changed so as not to offend immigrants. Immigrants by the million. Like they've allowed in the last 20 years into America the entire British population plus some. Over 70 million people have allowed into America. As the consequences of the Cultural Revolution, America has become two countries. The differences between us are wide, deep, and enduring. Less and less often do we take the trouble to find common ground with people unlike us in views and values. And then he goes on and he said back in the before the 60s, he said before 1965 we had been segregated. The blacks and the whites were segregated in housing and schools and so on. But, he says, we did share a common country and a common culture. We were one nation. We were Americans. We spoke the same language, learned the same history, celebrated the same heroes, observed the same holidays and holidays, went to the same films, rooted for the same teams, watched the same three channels, danced to the same music, ate the same food, and recited the same Pledge of Allegiance at school, and were taught the same truths about right and wrong, good and evil, God and country. We were a people then. And now? America is entering a time of troubles. The clashes of culture and creed are intensifying. And the crisis that afflict us, culture wars, race division, record deficits, unpayable debt, waves of immigration, legal and illegal, a people never before assimilated, gridlock in capital and possible defeat in war may prove too much for our democracy to cope with. I think that's a pretty good view of America. And Ephraim's a cake not turned. Something pretty bad has got to happen to our brother across the channel. Because America is still a frighteningly powerful nation. They have, I think, 11 battle groups headed by an atomic-powered aircraft carrier and a full squadron of ships. One of those could take on most nations and wipe them out. They got 11 of them. They are incredibly powerful. The weaponry they've got and stuff is amazing. And yet, when Ephraim sees his sickness and Judah sees his wound, there's no help from Uncle Sam. So what's going to happen to America? Is it going to be destroyed from within? Are they going to be hit by some real natural disasters? I mean, mega, that kill millions. What's going to happen? Ephraim and Israel are useless in God's eyes at the moment. Verse 9, strangers have devoured his strength and he knows it not. Yea, grey hairs are here and there upon him, yet he knows it not. You know, when I was a youngster, there was always the thing going on, buy British. People would make goods and they'd stamp a Union Jack on it. If you wanted a car, you bought a British car. And we had, oh, did we have cars? We had 20, 30 different manufacturers. British. Engines, everything, all the bits and pieces, British. Right? I actually drive, for my sins, an American car. You know what? Half of that thing's made in China. That's right. The body shell is an American design. The car was assembled in Germany, evidently, with bits from all over the world. Because that's what we've done. The bankers, the people who really control how things are done, look for where can they get the best value for their buck. We have it in this country. We had a chap called Mr. Dyson, who invented a wind-up radio and a few other things, a whole range of vacuum cleaners, which are quite incredible. But he couldn't get the help he needed, so what's he done? He's taken his whole factory and stuck it somewhere in the Far East. Over 1,000 people in this country lost their jobs. That's 1,000 people not buying cars, not buying houses, not buying food, clothing, not going out for meals. They're now sitting at home on the dole, being paid by the government. Rally bicycles. You can go on. The list is endless. America's even gone to the stage, right, where some parts that go into their fighter aircraft are made in China. Like, silly dove. Thick as two short planks, as they would say today. Verse 10. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Aren't the Americans proud? We're now talking about getting Israel and America together to go and beat up Iran. And America are getting the UN stirred up to let Turkey go in and beat up Syria. And it's quite incredible. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt, they go to Assyria. When we moved to Rhodesia, I was 12. And of course, you know, suddenly being in Africa, one became obviously the great big hunter. You had to hunt everything. I had an air rifle, and the damage I inflicted on the environment with that air rifle, I'd shudder. Anything that moved that was shootable at, you know, for a while anyway. But then my friend and I got into thinking, well, we should actually be trapping these animals. And then we can see them, we can feel them, touch them, get bitten by them, and all the rest of it. So we started with birds, and we tried all sorts of birds. But you know, there's one bird you can catch every time. It's a dove. They are thick. They really are stupid. All you need to do is get a dome of mesh, stick it, like you do on the comic books. So you have the stick and a piece of string, and you take a bit of grain, and you tick it, and you put a nice big pile of grain under there, and you get back behind a bush, and you stand there. Within half an hour, there'll be a dove, sometimes even two and three of them, and they'll follow along, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, bang, got them. So we could take them and feel them and stroke them and let them go. Right? Then it suddenly dawned on us, this is actually quite silly, because we're catching they're catching these things too easy. So I said, oh, we're catching the same ones. And my friend said to me, Bill said to me, he said, you've got to be joking. They wouldn't be that daft. So next time we caught them, we tied a little bit of red thread around the leg. Right. And then the next day we went out, and guess what? We caught three doves, and they all had red thread around the leg. You'd think they'd just look up and see this thing, saying, ooh, no, it's not a good idea. We noticed that a dove's nest had been destroyed by probably a big bird or kids or whatever. And you know what? She went right back and she rebuilt the nest in exactly the same place. Is that not what our people are doing today? Is that not what our people are doing today? It's quite incredible. And yet, all through Hosea, as with Mr. Armstrong, you get encouragement. Go back to chapter 1, verse 10. Having talked about all the drama and the troubles that are coming, he says, "Yet the number of children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' there it shall be said to them, 'You are the sons of the living God.'" Do you realize what that's saying? It's saying that these physical people who repent in the tribulation come back into the land and are the physical people that will go on into the millennium will end up in the family of God as sons. Tremendous. Chapter 2, verse 23. Verse 23 of chapter 2. "And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, 'You are my people.' And they shall say, 'You are my God.'" There's a change coming, isn't there? 3 verse 5. Chapter 3, verse 5. Afterwards, right? "Shall the children of Israel return and seek the Eternal their God and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days." Unfortunately, sometimes you've got to get people's attention first. And as one man said, the best thing to do to get a person's attention is to bash them on the head with a piece of two before. That gets the attention. You do it with children, don't you? Sometimes you've got to, yes, tune them up a little bit, and that gets the attention. Suddenly, the ears, suddenly the wax goes, and, oh, yes, yes, things are wonderful. See, God understands that people are not really going to get it until he pours out his Spirit. And that's what it says. You can all know Acts 2, verse 17. Just don't need to turn there. "It shall come to pass in the last days that I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams." So the message is twofold, and it's exactly what Mr. Armstrong preached. The punishment of Israel on the one hand, but the ultimate promise that they will return to God and will ultimately be part of the God family. So, God has a time and a place for every single person who has ever lived. I remember Mr. Waterhouse saying that he will put people in the position where they are given the best opportunity to make it into his family. That's why some people are called now, some have been called and they rejected it, some, whatever, they're in all sorts of states. But I'll tell you one thing, and that is this: God sent Mr. Armstrong as that end time Elijah, and he revealed through him the way, and that's what we've got to cling on to, and that's what everybody is going to have to be turned to. There is no other way. God is one way, and that's it. And then you come to chapter 14. That's this week is homework. Go read Hosea now and just see this mixture of, I'm going to beat you up to get your attention on the one hand, but then on the other hand, "O Israel, return unto the Eternal your God, for you have fallen by your lawlessness. Take with your words and turn to the Eternal and say, 'Take away all iniquity and receive us graciously, so we will render the calves of our lips. Asher," or Assyria, "shall not save us.'" In verse 4 he says, "I will heal their backsliding, I will love them freely. For my anger is turned away from him. I will be as a Jew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily and cast forth his roots in Lebanon." In the millennium. "His branches shall spread and his beauty shall be as the olive trees and his smell as Lebanon. They shall dwell under his shadow and shall return. They shall revive as the corn and grow as the wine. The scent thereof shall be as the wine of Lebanon." Ephraim shall say, verse 8, "What have I to do anymore with idols?" Earlier in the book it says Ephraim is wedded to idolatry. Even the pop idol culture. I noticed in the papers just recently that, forget the name of them now, one of these pop people, obviously a male and a female, got together and produced a love child. In other words, they're not married, But it's a love child. Yeah? That's not what God calls it. If you want to do a bit of homework, check it out. What have I to do with idols? I've heard him and observed him. I am like a green fir tree. From me is thy fruit found. I'm producing fruit. Who is wise? And he shall understand these things. Prudent, and he shall know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them, but transgressors shall fall therein. And this is the key. For the ways of the eternal are right, and the just shall walk in them. That's the key. The exciting thing is, our job description is to make this work under Jesus Christ very shortly.